Well, I'm really pleased to be able to talk here today because 2001 we had a symposium on erosion research methods for the 21st century in Honolulu, Hawaii. That's where I first met Jerry, and he gave a talk on the cesium-137 method. Just really excited me because I'd just recently taken a job with ARS and had a barn full of soil and aeolian samples from a series of fields that I'll show you here in a few minutes. But his openness to work with me and said, yes, just send it, just get these samples and send them. And his encouragement with the data afterwards just really opened this area to me. I'd like to recognize some co-authors, Michael Ketterer, chemist at Northern Arizona University, who's run some plutonium work for me, Ted Zobeck, my partner at the Wind Erosion and Water Conservation Research Unit in Lubbock, and Jerry, that I'd like to thank his creativity and his curiosity to solving problems is still being used in a powerful way. Okay, well, it's long been accepted that wind erosion is this winnowing process that removes the really fine, fertile parts of the soil and transports them to great distances. Some of the coarser material is deposited near the edge of the field. Some of the really fine material can circle the globe. So can we use change in a soil's chemical status to track some erosion history? Well, we really need a chemical species that is distributed evenly across the landscape. That's not just a product of the parent material lithology. It shouldn't be biologically active, so it shouldn't be taken up by animals that move to one corner of the field to spend the rest of the day. And ideally, we should know exactly at some point in time when this chemical species showed up in the environment. Well, guess what? Due to our ingenuity, we have created chemical species. And starting in July of 1945, when a nuclear explosion shattered the pre-dawn calm in New Mexico, there's been well over 500 atmospheric explosions set off by the United States, the USSR, and many other countries around the world. So, as Jerry found out, cesium-137 is an almost ideal chemical species to track soil movement across the landscape. For one thing, it didn't exist prior to 1945, and if we, it's not a part of the biological cycle. It's not taken up. Most of ingestion of cesium-137, when they looked at it more closely by grazing livestock, was due to soil splash being trapped onto the vegetation. It's got a half-life of about 30.2 years, so as opposed to a lot of the radioactivity soon after a blast, it stuck around on the landscape. So a few years after a blast, it and strontium basically are the two major players. And it was distributed globally by precipitation and dry deposition across the globe. Now, with the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty set to go in the first of the year of 1963, when you take a look at the blast records, the last quarter of 1962, the United States had several blasts a week, and the USSR sometimes had two blasts on a single day, leading down to the deadline when they could no longer take a blast. So we see a very sharp peak of deposition right here in 1963. Now, being a child that was about 8 years old in 1963, I can remember all the mothers in the neighborhood had been warned, don't let your kids eat snow. Now, luckily, I grew up in Texas. That wasn't a big issue, but when it did snow, we wanted to try it. Well, cesium-137 has been widely used as a tracer for water erosion studies. And some of this started out, Jerry was, you know, unarguably one of the pioneers. And for about the first 20 years, he and McHenry were about the only two that really used it extensively. And then about the mid-80s, other people started catching on and using it too. But much less is known about how cesium moves on wind-eroded sediments. And some of the first papers that mention wind erosion, they're using the 137 cesium technique to take a look at water erosion and then determine that the land was too flat to get much movement by water. So they had to look further. So the study area I had, and as I discussed this with Jerry, got really excited about it. We're on the southern high plains of Texas, one of the major dust producers in North America. We're a semi-arid farming region with very fragile sandy soils with less than 0.5% organic carbon and frequent high-velocity winds during the fallow season. So we've got this beautiful series of fields that they, because of the wind erosion modeling program back during the late 80s and early 90s, collected extensive information on erosion rates and deposition rates. We've got an area right here that was broken out in 1986 from this native grassland area. Now, this native grassland area is what we used for a reference area for this particular study. And we've got an area that was broken out in 1985, it's been farmed since 1986, an area that has been farmed continuously since 1915. And then we've got this area here that, for the wind erosion modeling program, they kept bare and flat and listed furrows around the edge of it to catch the sand cascading off the field. So this area right here is going to have, right there, very accelerated rates of erosion. And then we've got an Arizona cypress windbreak down here that's fairly far removed from this big erosion field, but it's this beautiful filter for the very, very fine materials eroding in the region. So we sample and analyze the surface soils from each of these fields, and we also sieve some surface soil from that area cultivated since 1915 to see how the cesium was distributed across the different size classes of particles. And we also took some aeolian samples from that barn full of samples that I talked about at five heights above an eroding surface, and we took a look at those and took a look at the cesium signatures in those. Well, to surface the soil, we took cores and we took 18 from each of these management areas and composited them to get the kilogram of soil that Jerry needed to do a representative count. And we cut it at several different depths. Cut it at 5, 10, 15, 30, and 45 centimeters to get our different depths to generate our profiles. Well, activities are represented in units of becquerels per kilogram. Inventories are represented in becquerels per unit area, in this case meter squared. So we took the depth of the soil and the bulk density to convert them. And we also ran a series of simulations using the suite of models published by Wallace and Hick in 2000, the IAEA, and just to see how well these would work with wind eroded data. Wind eroded sediments and histories. Well, when we took a look at the surface soils and the aeolian samples, we saw a marked and striking similarity here with the finer sediments that are lifted higher, containing higher activities. And then the inventories that we took a look at, or actually the activities of the soils here in this case, you can take a look right here. We have the reference site. So we see this typical logarithmic profile going down. The area that had only been cultivated since 1985, so only had 17 years of erosion history when we sampled it. We see the incorporation by tillage, and then a drop again at about 30 centimeters, it goes to zero. The area that had been eroded somewhat longer since 1915 had less activity in it, but again, by 30 centimeters had gone to zero. And then this area right here, I lose this cursor all the time. This is the area where we had lost close to 10 centimeters of soil during that 10 years of the worm project. So very high erosion rates on those white triangles. When we look at some of the depositional environments, we take a look here. Here's the original reference site again. This is the area under the Arizona cypress windbreak. So only 2 3/8 or so inches of soil had settled there, but very, very fine particles filtered out by the canopy and then rained out in throughfall. When we take a look at this area cultivated since 1915 again, it's the basically the same pattern that we saw on the other one. But where we had listed the rows to capture that sand, we see a profile that is buried. And so we see this activity going way down into the soil, and it was 60 centimeters or so before the activity had gone to zero. And our activity here of the reference site, actually the inventory of 1575 that Jerry measured for us, is very similar to the model predictions of 1500. Now, in arid environments, dust is everywhere, so you're going to get some dust deposition. So as Adrian Chappell points out in a couple of his papers, it's very, very hard to find a really good reference site in arid environments. Well, the measured activities for the other areas agreed favorably with the model predictions if we used a particle size correction factor of 1.18. And just to show you how well it worked, we used this area cultivated since 1985 to kind of train the model with the tillage practices that had been used up until that time. And we get the predicted erosion for that area of about 54 and a half tons per hectare per year. And so if we take that and subtract that off for the years of cultivation for the other areas, and then run the simulations on it, we see that for this accelerated erosion area, we get very, very good agreement of the rates of erosion for that time period. And for the infield deposition area, we also get very, very good agreement, and the area under the windbreak as well, identical. So this works out really well, and so we conclude that it's a very useful tracer to estimate soil redistribution due to wind erosion in addition to water erosion. And that the models that folks have developed to estimate these rates do work well with wind eroded sediments as long as you have a proper particle size correction factor. And that should be about 1.18 for sandy loam soils. And it's going to vary by soils and location, I'm sure. Unfortunately, with a half-life of 30.2 years for cesium, only about 30% of the original inventory is still in existence, just due to decay. So we started taking a look at other isotopes that we might be able to use. And another problem is, in 1986, when the power plant at Chernobyl burned up, it spread a lot of cesium-137 all over Northern Europe and Western Asia. So the areas out there, this technique's really come into question. So some of the other isotopes are biologically active, such as strontium-90 and rubidium-86. They're analogs of essential elements. They get taken up by plants. They're distributed across the landscape by animals. Well, 239 and 240 plutonium are the fuel for most of the atomic bombs that were detonated. Not all of it entered into fission, so there's unused material that got scattered out across the landscape. It's got a half-life of 24,000 years for plutonium-239, which is the primary weapons-grade fuel, and 6,500 years for 240 plutonium. What's really interesting is considering the probability and possibility of local contamination, we know what the ratio between those two radioisotopes is from the stratospheric fallout. It's about 0.18. So, you know, we can take a look at it. If it varies much from that, then we know that potentially we've got a local source of contamination. So we took the very same samples that Jerry had run through his gamma specs and sent back to us, and we split off some 25-gram samples and dry ashed them. And we added a aliquot of plutonium-242 for a yield tracer and extracted it with nitric acid and then exchanged it out onto some Teva resin beads. We washed those out and got rid of the uranium and thorium off the beads and then eluted it with ammonium oxalate to yield this 2 milliliter aliquot for ICP-MS analysis. And here you see the aliquots being taken at Mike's lab in Arizona. Well, recognize those curves? These are plutonium. They're very similar. The activities are about 1/50th of what we saw in the cesium-137, but the patterns are almost identical. So when we took a look at the actual comparisons, here are the soil profiles, and we get an R-square of 0.975, which is pretty darn good. And when we take a look at the samples that we sieved, the attic samples, and all of the Aeolian samples, we get even better agreement. So we really think that this has promise, and I sent the data set to Jerry in about March, and I said, well, I think it doesn't get much better than this, and he said, yeah, it shows some promise. So in conclusion with the plutonium study, the data agree well and with the cesium-137 results and for the reference eroded and depositional soils. And I think it shows great promise as a soil tracer for future studies because basically for centuries to come, the activity won't change in the soil and the inventories won't change unless the soil is redistributed. And right now all we know is for semi-arid environments. We're not sure how well this is going to work in humid environments. There's some indication in the literature that shows that plutonium may be a little bit more prone to moving with organic materials than cesium was, so we need to take a look at that. Further work is definitely needed in this area. And with that, I offer you this picture taken in September of Ted Zobeck, John Tatarko, and I getting on with that work at a field site in Michigan. And it was real interesting to hear that Walnut Gulch, that Jerry and Carol went out to the airport to take the reference sites because this is one of a couple of reference sites that we sampled while we were up in Michigan. And with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Thanks, John. Any questions for Scott?
Okay.
Did the plutonium have distribution was that correlated pretty much with the way the cesium was distributed through the stratosphere?
Yes, identically. Yeah. In fact, most of the models that predict how much cesium was deposited in an area and plutonium are both functions of strontium because initially they really weren't looking for either of those two. As early as 57, they realized there was a problem with strontium getting into the milk supply. So they were looking for strontium everywhere on the landscape.
Yes? In terms of the analytical, are they same time consuming or
which? Actually, the plutonium goes fairly quickly. You can extract a large number of soils in a small amount of time, and then the actual time in the torch on the ICP-MS is about 10 minutes a sample. And we heard earlier today that Jerry was running samples for, 24 hours or so, sometimes more. Yeah. So that just opens up the possibility for wide-scale spatial distribution studies fairly quickly and inexpensively.
Thanks, Scott.